Group meeting, Friday, 10th October, 1980.
I think we are all aware by now that the purpose of living the religious life is to enable man to come to full fruition as a human being, bearing in mind the deep meaning of the word human, the blissful creator. And of course, that is the term we apply in the theistic religions to God. So, to become godlike, because after all, any conception of God is a projection out of our minds of all that we consider our good qualities in apotheosis. So that's what it implies, that the human being shall become fully human. The Son of Man becomes identical with the teaching which is embodied in the phrase the Son of God. Man's perfection, man's fruition, and man in the sense of the entire human race. And that perfection and fruition is exemplified through individual people. It is not so much that I become God, although there are phrases like that, the deification of man, occurring even in the writings of the Christian mystics. And that is saying a lot, really. St. Bernard was one of them. I know there were one or two others too, but I've forgotten their names at the moment. That is the purpose of the religious life as such. What actually happens to us as individuals? What change takes place? The fundamental change is the complete transformation of our mode of awareness of existence. The kind of consciousness we have now is utterly transformed into a different kind of consciousness. And it is a consciousness where one is constantly aware of transcendence, of the context of infinity, eternity and immortality as the root source, the basic ground of all existence. At present, such words as infinity, eternity and immortality are just words. They are inconceivable. And of course they will everlastingly be inconceivable in our ordinary sense of the word conceiving. Simply because in that transformed consciousness there are no words of our languages to express it. We cannot use words which belong to the languages of the world, which represent the finite, the temporal, and the mortal. We can't use those words to express the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal. Our words go only this far, that they can negate the limitations that we know. Our finitude, well, we negate that limitation of finiteness by the word infinite. But it's a negative word. It's non-finite. You see, it's like that. And eternity is non-temporal. And immortality is non-mortal. It is the deathless. Well now, in connection with this, we must always bear in mind that our consciousness functions in terms of finitude, temporality, and mortality only. Whatsoever action we perform, whatsoever thought we have or feeling, whatsoever effort we make, it has a beginning, a proceeding, and an ending. Birth, growth, and death. And often that it isn't a growth, it's a regressive change, not a progressive change. We have to bear all that in mind, that these are our limitations. We are limited creatures. Now, what is it fundamentally that affects our whole life? It is our consciousness, the way we are conscious. People tend to muddle up this statement with a state of mind. Consciousness is not a state of mind. We do talk of modes of consciousness, of grades. We talk of entering the deeps and that sort of thing. And up to a point, that is all right. But consciousness itself is something which we don't know. It is like the primordial creative energy, out of which comes the totality of all manifestation, whatever it is. What is that primordial creative energy? I don't know. And no one knows really. That is to say, knows with the brain. That aspect of mind, which is the most concrete and the most limited, is the aspect which works through the brain. And there is that other, the rest of that realm of mind, which is transcendent, which is infinite, and which is the archetypal expression of the primordial creative energy, which releases a cosmos out of primordial chaos. Primordial chaos is not disorder. You find Hesiod amongst the Greek teachers, the Greek poets, and of course you find in India those who have pointed out that what we in English call chaos, intending to mean disorder, is not disorder. It's a different state of order. It's a vibrant quiescence. That's the phrase I use. It's my own invention, if you like. It's a vibrant quiescence. And out of that vibrant, when that vibrant quiescence begins to limit itself, and people ask, well, why and how, what makes it limit itself? This is a very ancient teaching. It comes both in the Kabbalah and in the original Veda, the Vedic teachings. The desire to know itself. Now, this doesn't mean that it is unconscious at the start. Primordial creative energy is not unconscious. It is identical, in fact, with pure consciousness, with absolute consciousness. But whatsoever is absolute cannot know itself as an object. It is the eternal absolute subject. It cannot know itself as an object. Now, we can take a state of mind and look at it and analyze it and be aware of it as something outside the brain. We can say that, or a state of mood. We are depressed or we are elated. See, now we can sort of regard that objectively, separate from ourselves. But that which is pure consciousness is something which again can never be defined, and it remains forever unknowable by the brain, by consciousness functioning in its limited state through our thoughts, feelings, activities, and through the senses. The senses are the great restrictors, limiters, limitation makers of consciousness, of this pure consciousness. So now, whatever is our innermost state of consciousness, we don't know. We can know our external the external manifestations of our state of consciousness. The manifestations occur in what we call are obvious in what we call our states of mind, or our moods, and so on. The state of mind must not be mixed up with innermost consciousness. The state of mind actually is a state of the psyche, which is rooted in the brain and nervous system, and is influenced by the activity of the ductus glands. That is our psyche. So that we can know. That comes within the sphere of our experience. But the innermost depth of consciousness we don't know. That is the divine embodied in us, the transcendent embodied in us. Just as the body itself is this primordial creative energy manifesting this particular form and shape in the universal scheme. If we can sort of get the feel of these things, we will get the feel of the very roots, the very ground, ultimate ground of our existence and our life and our growth and our fruition as such. So, understanding this, we must next try and understand this thing which I call being subsumed. I have explained it before, but there are several points associated with this. That which is the profounder, the greater, is the all-inclusive. That which is not so profound, not so great, not so complete, is the limited expression. But all limitation is subsumed. All conditioning is subsumed in the unconditioned and the unlimited. See, our space consciousness, ordinarily as it functions, is three-dimensional. That is why we can cognize a solid object straight away. Now, if you analyze a solid object, you start with a point which has no dimensions whatsoever. No length, no breadth, no depth. All three dimensions are absent. Now, that point has only a conceptual existence. It has no real material existence at all. Because the point is a word which comes out of geometry. It's a geometrical conception. A point, as we say. No dimensions whatsoever. Now, one cannot sort of take hold of an infinite number of points and put them side by side and say that is a line. You can't do that. Because where the line is concerned, the point as a point has disappeared. Any point has disappeared. All points conceived as such are in that line. You see? But the point itself, where the line is concerned, has disappeared. How does a line really come into being? Not by putting points side by side in our own minds, but by moving that point. You move the point and it produces a line. It's a mystery. It's an act of creation, if you like. You see, it's a marvelous thing. Now, note carefully. A line. You draw a line like that. And that again is a limited thing. It is one dimensional and it has a certain length, as we call it, which we can measure. Now, note carefully, the context of the finite and the limited in one dimension contains the infinite, the non-finite points in terms of an infinite number of points. So you see, the two contexts exist simultaneously. The infinite and the finite. An infinite number of points are subsumed, I don't say contained deliberately, they are subsumed in the one-dimensional line. You get it? This is very... Now, why do I not say contained? Because when we use the word contained, the brain immediately conjures up... Our brain defines the word contained in the sense in which a box has a number of articles inside it. You see? Now, it is not like that. The number of articles, are all definite, finite articles in a definite, finite box. And there is no mistaking about that. But in the case of the point and the line, the movement of the point, and movement means life. The conceptual point sort of come to life like that, in its movement has produced a one-dimensional finite line. The movement of the point produces a line which actually is conceptually the same as a countless infinite number of points. Now it's the same when the line moves. It produces a surface. So, your surface, which is measurable, so it's so long and it is so broad, although it is measurable, it consists of an infinite number of lines. So again, you've got the context of the unlimited, the unconditioned, the infinite, subsuming the conditioned, the limited, and the finite. Now you see, this happens, I give these simple examples, simply because we can easily sort of picture them intellectually. But this happens, this is a fact, both with regard to our mental aspect, the whole of our psychological life, as well as what we may call our spiritual life. Now if you sort of spend, when you're by yourself, spend time just brooding over this. Meditate on it. Don't go on talking endlessly, you see, about it. But just sort of get the picture of it. Get the feel of it. And extraordinary things will happen. The potentiality of pure mind in us will become more active. And we'll be more sensitive, more alert in relation to the limitation of our mental activities through our psyche. So one sees how your mind, my mind, as we call it, which of course it's a miscalling. There is no such thing as my mind, just as there is no such thing as my space. I can't take hold of a bit of space at all and say, this belongs to Firoz Mehta, don't enter. Or any such thing. You can't do that. But you'll get that awareness of being subsumed in the ground of our existence. And that is very, very important where living the good life is concerned. Because it is that awareness, which is still very dim at the start, is the source, the power which enables us to feel and think rightly without trying to define exactly what is right and exactly what is not right. It won't remain vague. It will be really quite lighted up. This is one of the meanings of enlightenment. This lighting up process from within, the awareness, the consciousness is undergoing a transformation. And as a result of that, you will find that all your thinking, feeling, your speaking, your activities, your plans, your relationships, they will all undergo change gradually. Sometimes not even gradually, but very, very swiftly, very suddenly. And make an extraordinary change in your actual everyday life. It's like it is one of the real meanings of the word conversion. You see, as they say of St. Paul at Damascus, he went into he fainted, didn't he? Well, he didn't faint, actually. He was all there, only completely transformed in inner consciousness, a state which seemed at that moment to have no relationship with Saul of Tarsus. It's like that, this change which comes about. So now, we see then that our whole growth is one, our whole development and coming to fruition is one in which the context of transcendence, the infinite, the eternal, the immortal, is intimately bound up with the finite, the temporal, and the mortal. It's very important to recognize this. Otherwise, you know, we can go on arguing till the cows come home, quite uselessly, about statements like, in Him we live and move and have our being. But when one begins to see this, and not just see it logically with the brain, but begin to get the feel of it in our own living being, then this transformation of the living being proceeds apace. What are some of the obstructions to this sort of vision and realization? We imagine that we would like to live the good life and realize human fruition and so forth. We imagine that, but how intense, how earnest is this desire for the fruition? Our everyday life is the testing ground. Something happens which just takes us, depresses or covers over our spiritual aspiration. And the power of that impulse of spiritual aspiration is reduced almost to zero, and we act in the subhuman way and not the truly human way. Our vested interests and so on, vested interests in all departments, our emotional life, our family life, our business life, and so on and so on, everything. Those vested interests, when life just gives a little prick, how do we react? Like the saint or not such a saint? This is the testing ground, you see. But if we do allow ourselves, whenever the opportunity lets us do so, or whenever we make the opportunity to do so, if we let our mind, our attention, brood upon, just stay with some of these at present just mere thoughts, the change keeps taking place. Now that doesn't mean that the change which keeps taking place will be one which will make everything in the garden lovely. Not at all. Because whenever there is some improvement, some betterment, it involves an ascesis, the true asceticism, the relinquishing, the renouncing, the removal of that which is obstructive to the pure, the beautiful, the true. That is always the case, isn't it so? You remember how often, especially during past years, I used to use that simile. You can't sprinkle out of a bottle something called cleanliness and expect the room to be clean. What you have got to do is to remove the dust and the dirt and all that, and then the room is clean, and that's that. It's something like that. If we can let our vision, knowledge is not the right word. I think vision is about the best word I can use. If let our vision become more and more full of light, then this process of ascesis goes on and transforms consciousness to start with, and also our psyche as well as the body. The very body becomes transformed ultimately. The cells of the body and so forth, they all undergo change. And particularly the cells, the brain cells, they undergo change. Modern science is also slowly beginning to take that point of view. There are men who do recognize that the old idea that the brain cells just die and there's no rejuvenation of them, that apparently is not quite so true now. So you see, there's more than hope. So now, let us continue with understanding the working of consciousness. We talked about the point. Now, supposing we pay attention to a point, what sort of a relationship is it? It has this curious factor. Whereas, in relationship to anything which has dimensions, 1, 2, 3. The relationship between oneself and that is the relationship of a subject and an object of attention. Isn't it so? Isn't that so? You are conscious of yourself as the subject. I am looking at this. I am listening to this. Or tasting this. Or touching this. Etc. etc. There is a subject-object relationship. A person-thing relationship. But the point is not a thing. It's an absolutely arbitrarily defined thing. It has no dimensions, no length, no breadth, no depth. It has no mass, no weight. It has no properties whatsoever apart from being nothing, no thing. It is a no thing in the real sense. But in being a no thing lies its extraordinariness altogether. It is not finite. It is temporal. It has a time measure. The time measure is, of course, the amount of time you pay attention to it. So that particular point has a time measure. But as far as the space measure is concerned, it is infinite, non-finite. See, this is one of the difficulties with words. We are so accustomed to use the word infinite in terms of bigness, not of smallness. But the point is non-finite, just as much as the total universe is well, it is supposed to be finite. In fact, it has a definite radius and all the rest of it. But for our purposes, it's enough to say that the entire cosmos is infinite. Now, this is a curious thing. Again, we see how the context of the transcendent subsumes the finite and the temporal and the mortal, and the finite is rooted in the infinite. It's very important to sort of get the feel of these things, the sense of these things, because they have their counterpart in terms of the deeps of consciousness, which touch the holy spiritual realms as such. Now, in attending to a point which is no thing, if the attention becomes sufficiently intense, we've said it's a subject or person and no thing relationship. A person in relation to no thing. The point is no thing whatsoever. Now, what happens if the attention becomes sufficiently intense? You will find that the isolating element in self-consciousness, I, the subject, begins to diminish and it vanishes. So that whilst the I consciousness actually functions in terms of the transcendent context of the eternal and the immortal, the limiting element of the I consciousness, selfness in other words, has vanished. Extraordinary things happen. With what is apparently, some people will say, oh, what a lot of words, quite useless words. Well, all right, if he says so, he's welcome to what he says, and he'll leave it alone if he's sensible. If he's not sensible, he'll produce arguments against it. But if he goes on producing arguments against it sufficiently long and sufficiently vigorously and sufficiently honestly, he will end up with discovering that he had made a slight mistake. This is the point, you see. So now, that is one way, if you like, a totally transpersonal way. I won't say impersonal merely. It's a transpersonal way, because there is a person who is attending. It's a transpersonal way of going completely beyond all selfness. The root of all selfishness is out when that isolating self-consciousness is out, and consciousness functions quite purely without any isolative element in it, separating it. I am this and the point is that. So these are ways and means if you like, of enabling consciousness to free itself from the limitations it has at present. So, when that attentiveness has become sufficiently intense, there is a state of pure or absolute consciousness, which is identical with the primordial creative energy. Because it is this, whatsoever is that primordial creative energy, is also absolute consciousness. It has creative power. Our consciousness and the changing of our consciousness, our growth in consciousness, is the thing that changes us as well as our circumstance. We attempt to change our circumstance in the wrong way. Practically all mankind does it. We attempt to change an unhappy or a difficult or a bad circumstance in terms of preconceived notions of what is the good. Isn't that so? We have an idea that, if I had a big house with 10 rooms, all mod cons and so forth, that is an indispensable, I don't like this tiny little cottage. And so we attempt to change our present context of the finite and the temporal and the mortal only in terms of another finite and temporal and mortal. There is no transformation of inner consciousness into something really profounder, which spells our true growth and ultimate fruition. So you see, to go for circumstances and what is not the best at the moment, in that way, simply keeps us bound down to the lower state, the irreligious condition. The religious aspiration, the religious drive, should enable us to get free of the limitations imposed upon our mode of awareness by our desires, our particular ideas, our particular conceptions about how things ought to be. We don't know how they ought to be. Take anything which is alive. How does it grow? When you plant an oak, an acorn, it will grow into an oak, we know. But does the acorn know that? The acorn has no idea at all. Take a newborn child. Can that newborn child have any conception of what, limit ourselves to its physical body, what that body will look like and be like in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years? It just can't. It happens. Life does all that. Life, which is assisted or hindered by that child's mistakes as he grows up and the mistakes of those who are in charge of the child. Mustn't forget that. You see? We are all interactive. There is no one in the world, there is no thing whatsoever in the world which is not in intimate interaction and interrelationship with all the rest of the world. Now this is something of which we are ignorant even intellectually. The mass of people are quite ignorant of that. You go to the TUC conference or to the conservative conference, find out how many of the people who control the destinies of the 55 millions of the world are aware of just exactly how things happen. They just haven't got the vaguest idea. They really haven't. They may have certain thoughts, certain beliefs, which consist of a string of words. But what those words really mean, and the living power in those words to change things, they don't know. They just believe. Like the man who goes to church and says, "I believe in God the Father," etc., etc., etc. He doesn't know what he's talking about. He may make a picture, and as you know, it's the stock joke since the days of Adam. Father, of course, has a long white beard and he sits on a throne. The Father in heaven, concept, you see. It's like that. So, we have to direct our attention in the right way. Attentiveness is, true attentiveness is a directing of consciousness. And as that consciousness changes, this primordial creative energy works more harmoniously, more easily. It is not obstructed by our drawbacks, and it changes the circumstance in which we live. Often it doesn't, because one must remember that one is not alone in the world. One is surrounded by millions of people who do not live like that, who the force generated by their mode of living can destroy the good things that good individuals can release into the world. There's a tremendous universal force working against us all the time. That is to say, it doesn't work against us necessarily consciously, but it works, it functions obstructively simply because it is there. If you get a very dense fog outside, the fog doesn't consciously prevent you from seeing your way and avoiding a collision with a car, with other cars or something on the big motorways. It is obstructive. Its nature is obstructive. And we are going through it, and we have to be so very careful. It's something like that. Roughly handled,